through some arrangement. I notice Walt uses the phrase federal communities in his paper. Well, I suspect federal communities must be awfully close to reservations. And that seemed to me that's one of the few mistakes we didn't make in public policy in Alaska, to use widespread use of federal communities arrangements. And Walt uses the very interesting phrase, relatively irrevocable, when talking about a trust. Maybe attorneys have a definition of what a relatively irrevocable trust is, but it seems to me that's an unhealthy way to go. Now, if it's true that what we teach in economics and finance courses at universities, and what I suspect is taught at the Chamber of Commerce in Anchorage, that shareholders really control corporations, something that's, of course, not all that obvious. But if, under the present circumstances, there is a small d democracy to shareholders and how shareholders make corporations behave, and control is really there, if that is correct, then the task that he talks about, the problem of getting hundreds and maybe thousands of persons to go agree on something, is just the right task. That's it. That's what you do, is to go do that and decide whether something is to be extended or changed or altered. And so I don't find that. It's pretty frightening, I suppose, and it could be pretty painful. But the notion of shareholders behaving as shareholders, presumably freely and willingly, is, I think, again, a concept that we had in mind playing out when this feature of the 1985s and the 1991s come due. Now, I think Walt gets to it correctly, especially at the end of his paper, when he says the major protection for the future are institutions which benefit all Alaskans, irrespective of location or race, and that this is the way to get political support for something as citizens of a state, and that that is a broad-based, that will be a broad-based political support, and that is the genius of political support, is to make it broad-based, and that that is the right direction to pursue, and that state sovereignty of the private variety offers the very best range of options and opportunities for natives, is a sentence in Walt's paper, and I think that's entirely on target as an opinion. I think there should be a rejection of the tribal arrangements or federal arrangements. After all, what you don't need, in my view, is more factions or fractions of the native community. We don't need to replay the secession of Quebec from the Canadian circumstance. I think that for Canada also is just the wrong way to go. We don't need more factions and fractions. Now, Walt says that the best feature of the Claims Act is the flexibility it offers in for succeeding generations of natives to shape the future. I think that's right. I don't think that's just 4th of July rhetoric. That's right on target in my view. He mentions the other side of the coin is the hazard. And that's right, opportunities almost always involve hazards. And that, I think, brings us full circle to the thrust of the Native Land Claim Settlement, the underlying concept of the act that I think was there. And that was to settle up, in a sense, once and for all, certainly with respect to those claims, to compensate for the past takings, to allow time to prepare to transition to other arrangements, to enjoy some good happenings in the meantime, like early dividend distributions, and so that everybody has a chance, anyway, an opportunity to take their place, not separate and not different, if they choose to be fully enfranchised in the way that that term is not used in the sense of voting in politics, but fully enfranchised in the sense of participation. A couple, Mr. Chairman, a couple remarks or two that have come up from the morning session, as I know Bill and I, the last two participants, I think Rosita may be the last, the third participant, but the that come to mind with these, just a remark or two. The subsistence use matter. Complicated, emotional, important. For good or ill, I think that most of the view at the time of passage of the land claim settlement of the subsistence use item was that it was maybe one-third legitimate argument on the merit and two-thirds a method for extending the size of the land portion of the settlement. I say for good or ill of one's view about it. And I'd be interested if Bill or others have a vastly different recollection, that once you've done the going from 10 million acres and going to 44 million acres, and then the selection for land potential and hardship and to that, and then the subsistence and land use portion, which was not included in the Field Committee's original proposal, as I recall it. It left it to the state of Alaska, state administration, to see to the fair handling of those issues that would arise, I would say there was some worry by a lot of outside participants, not so much Alaska group, that was a adroit vehicle for substantial additions to the land portion of the settlement. The final point, I think that while it's not a major part of it, if you care about analysis and your job and world has always been with analysis and information provision and caring about policy preparation and so on, I think we might at least record that part of the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act was a little amendment that created the Joint Federal-State Land Use Planning Commission, which served Alaska well, I think, till about, I think I have its last report, its final report, 1979, and that was a very appropriate place to put this Land Use Planning Commission, because it was just crucial that when you launch this thing, that you have a good attention to kind of the hard analytical work about land use planning in Alaska. And the small anecdote to that was that one day I visited Attorney General Havelock in Juneau with a little draft of that idea, and in an afternoon we whipped that out and got the governor's agreement and got back and got Senator Jackson's agreement, and the Federal-State Land Use Planning Commission was allowed. And an important part of that allowance is, to me, back to the point of co-equality, that while you may not think of it a lot on the front of your mind, it was, because Alaska is pretty lively and assertive as a state, but it was always a question of how to get Alaska as a state government to really see itself as co-equal to the federal government in the sense of federal-state relations. And so there was always, I thought, a useful way to construct the mechanism. I'm thinking of the Federal Field Committee itself, where the governor was the co-director of the Federal Field Committee. It was an idea to get, not make the state, but not coerce and not cajole, but to get the state to think of itself as a full and fair participant on these matters. And so the follow-on group, the Joint Federal-State Land Use Planning Commission, where in fact the state became very, very participatory, was meeting one of the goals that I think we had in mind, that act, with respect to state government and the federal government. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jones, for I think a spirited defense of a view of ANCSA based on mid-20th century notions of liberal democracy and notions widely shared in the United States and Alaska and in Canada as well. May I, as a footnote to your paper, just say a word about Quebec? Well.
That was gratuitous.
It is only fitting since the Prime Minister of Canada has resigned. Well, I'd be willing to do so, but then I'd have to translate, I think. Canada adopted a new constitution in 1982, and French-speaking Canadians That is, because they have a language of their own, have certain rights throughout Canada. They have rights as French-speaking Canadians. It's a characteristic that attaches to your language. They have the right to public assistance for their own for education in their own language wherever they live in Canada. And these are rights shared by English-speaking Canadians wherever they live, and especially in Quebec, because we have an Anglo minority of 1 million in Quebec, and Francophone, that is French-speaking minorities, in every other province. So that our Constitution actually enshrines all of the notions that are in your Bill of Rights as it was enacted back in 1791, and yet we have included as well certain specific provisions that recognize two official languages, recognize that the country is bilingual and bicultural, and which as well give certain rights. And this is not in keeping with the notions of liberal democracy that I think you espouse. It gives certain rights to people who speak English or French, and those rights are exercisable anywhere in the country, the idea being that the country is the homeland of both English and French-speaking Canadians. Our Constitution also enshrines certain rights of Aboriginal peoples, and in that sense perhaps goes beyond, if that's a neutral expression, the constitutional arrangements that you made or adopted in 1791. Forgive me, this is an international look at these things, and will become clearly so week after next. And the beauty of this a discourse on my part is that, apart from my wife, I don't think there's anybody else in the room who can argue with me about it. Well, Mr. Van Ness, we said you would have the last word of these opening statements.
Abuse you of that last notion, too, before we're through. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to have been invited to participate in what I consider a very important, very healthy kind of mid-course review of the Native Claims Settlement Act, where you are with it now, what positive things have flown from it, and what problems there are still with it. At the outset, I do want to make clear that the views that I'm going to express here today are my own and not attributable to any of the past or present clients. And secondly, I have to sadly report that this distinguished panel has plowed this ground at least twice from two different angles, and there's very, very little left to say that's new in terms of contributing here. Just very generally, though, it's my view that ANCSA has been a very, very successful piece of legislation measured against other federal legislation that is also precedent-setting, unique, dealing with socially complex, historically and legally complex problems, at least by all of the measures that I see in Washington, D.C., and when I'm up here two or three times a year, and when I gauge back to the way it was when we had the initial hearings in February 68 here in Anchorage, that in general it's been a very, very successful thing. It was, as a number of the panelists have noted, a very radical effort at social engineering. And it was done on a very, very calculated basis. And I think that most of the participants understood that there were massive risks that they were undertaking here. The question of the fact that most of the people who wound up in positions of top leadership in the regional corporations, in the village corporations, knew very, very little about the corporation, very, very little about the cash economy in some cases, very, very unsophisticated. They had access to varying grades of competence in consultants and investment advisors and attorneys, and they made a lot of mistakes in some instances. But even recognizing those mistakes and looking back on it, they did terrifically well, in my judgment. And one of the reasons, I think, was that there was a total new challenge here, that the Native leadership and their advisors, people they turned to, had a once-in-a-lifetime challenge. They rose to the occasion that the human spirit reached to the depths and brought out the best leadership and competence and everybody that was involved. And that's got a bad side to it, too, that I see that about the experience, and that is that most of these people, like Byron Mallott and others, they're still in those same leadership positions, and you've got the younger people coming up behind them, and there really aren't enough leadership roles. There's kind of a vacuum there, that there's so many of you that are young, exceedingly competent, and now well-experienced, that I think one of the problems you're going to see in here in the villages, Mr. Chairman, is that there need to be new institutional opportunities, new institutions, perhaps, for these younger folk to exercise their leadership skills at a different point in time and bringing to bear different values, different perspectives, different assessments as to what is important about this culture and new ways to define the relationship to the land in the context of a world that's changed greatly from what it was in 68 or 72 or when your first aspirations about settling this land problem were, and they go back to well before 68, obviously, that they were raised in statehood. They were raised before then. But that's a problem, and I think one that needs to be addressed, and I think needs to be addressed very carefully, and I suspect, from my point of view, somewhat conservatively. Switching to another point, there's some blame to be passed around here, I guess. There's a great deal of credit to be taken, and it's my judgment that by and large, the Alaska Native people wrote ANCSA, that they won, in general, the councils of war that none of us saw that were held in the hotels in D.C. when they got together and had to make the tough decisions about were they going to compromise with Wayne Aspinall or Scoop Jackson or Gordon Allett on an issue, that in the end, you look at it, they won 95% of those compromises. It's their bill. They wanted 12 ethnic regional corporations that followed the lines that they'd agreed upon and organized on. The Senate wanted 7. Said some were too small, too weak, lacked resources, too remote. They ought to be stronger. The Senate wanted to have an overall institutional investment advisory corporation, like a big mutual fund, that took half the assets and ran it in there and had cautious, conservative, blue-chip Wall Street investments that were the best and the safest that could be made, and that was in part for the benefit, really, of the afterborn, that there would be something there for later generations, even if the economy went bad and things didn't work out and it was a bust otherwise, there was still going to be something there. But the young, aggressive, competent Native leadership of Alaska didn't want that. They didn't want one big corporation. They wanted to make their own decisions, that is, the individuals and the individual regions. They wanted to exercise their judgment on behalf of their particular needs as they understood them, on behalf of their people. And they won on that. On the question that John raises about the whole question of, well, there should be a social welfare institution, a corporation, a Native foundation to look after the social welfare side, again, the Native people, by and large, didn't want it, and as a result, didn't get it. In this case, they were able to couple with many who feared statewide institutions that were massive, large, politically powerful, that had the potential of controlling the economy of the state. So it was a marriage of convenience in that sense. But again, the Native community and the Native leadership won on that issue, and I guess time will tell whether they were right on it. But again, their arguments they brought to bear were good, that for their region and their culture and their people, they were in the best position to be making the day-to-day decisions about investments, about social welfare, about land tenure, and about culture. Next point is a question that John and others have touched on here, and that is the limitations of the modern business-for-profit corporation. I don't share John Havelock's concern that the corporation is too limited to be responsive, because the corporation throughout American life has turned out to be a very creative, very, very responsive, very, very dynamic institution, able to adapt itself to doing everything that gets done in this country practically that the government doesn't do per se. And the government very often gets those things done by replicating that pattern through a ComSat and through a variety of other federal corporations that are and banking institutions that are patterned after the private corporation. I think the problem is somewhat different here. I think you can amend state law to have small corporations, smaller village corporations, profit or nonprofit, that are somewhat closely held, that are designed to enlarge the control of the land and for those people and fit their circumstances. By the same token, you can do the same thing at the state level. I think it's a serious, serious mistake to think that you can or should launch an effort to, or that the effort, if it's successful, would be good for you to have a federal corporation, whether you're talking about the federal IRA pattern, which I think is terribly wrong. It's a creature of the 30s. It's a different time for a different set of problems. It has been, by and large, a tragic thing, in my judgment, because nothing has come of it, for the most part, except misery, grief, and an awful lot of problems, and not much opportunity. Part of that's because the federal government's involved, extensively involved. It's wardship, it's trusteeship, it's the Bureau of Indian Affairs and all its worst aspects, and it's nothing in the way of opportunity, in my judgment. By the same token, a pattern of federal corporations after ComSat, after the national banking system, is not good. The Alaska Native people got the attention of Congress once, and that was because of oil. It was after Prudhoe Bay, and that's the only reason you got their attention. I mean, you'd send down delegations of 5 to 15 of your most competent people and a few attorneys to town, but you had their attention. It was riveting. You had a great story to tell. You told it well. You played it right. You won every trade-off, and the amount of land went up and up and up. The dollars went up and up, and in my judgment, you closed the deal at the right time, because if you'd waited another week, it'd have been gone. But the point is that whatever kind of new corporate creation you get, if you want something other than the IRA, it's going to be full of mistakes. It's going to have to be revisited time after time after time to make it even work. And you're back to trying something all new that basically is a new institution with new problems. And it's going to be years before you get right back down to where you have the opportunity to be now, which is solving substantive problems, problems of land, land and culture, social problems, using tried instruments and institutions that they're not perfect, but you know how to use them. They're cost-effective. The dollars that are passing through your corporations as a function of consultant time and lawyer time are going down. You less and less need the consultants. You less and less need the lawyers. If you go into new institutional arrangements, you're rediscovering the wheel, and you're going to come up with something, in my judgment, that's not going to be really any better. Touching on the point of oil, you had a little window that opened up in connection with the D2 lands bill. You had the environmental community, the desire of federal land agencies to fight this out and find out what the Forest Service was going to get and so forth. So you got in there, you had their attention, and as a lawyer at that time was representing one of the regional corporations, we layered in page after page of amendments to ANCSA and opening up new opportunities, because that was the only opportunity that had come along since the adoption of the Native Land Claim Settlement Act. And I don't see any real other opportunities. You've got an 85 or 86 report coming out of the statute. I don't think that's going to be a legislative opportunity. I think that's going to be a lot of shouting and screaming and recriminations, and it's not going to get anybody's attention to the point of reserving 5 days for hearings, field hearings, getting people lined up on legislation, and then taking 8 or 10 days of the two jurisdictional committees to mark it up. It's not going to happen. You may have a little window of an opportunity in connection with the 86 report on the ANWR, the Alaska the Wildlife Refuge, up on the slope, because the oil companies, again, are going to be in that one. That's going to be a big one. It's going to get people's attention. you're going to be poised to do some amending to take care of some of the smaller problems, mid-course directions, without stopping and rethinking this whole issue, trying to go back and educate people on its historical antecedents, in effect replicating the Native Claims Settlement Act, look at that opportunity. There may be a chance to get the 30 or 40 pages of amendments that and opportunities that you're capable of doing, but it's not even clear that that's going to go. If that isn't it, you're really off to 1990, 1991, and making a heck of a good case to get people's attention. One of the real problems you've got is the people that were there in 68 and 70 and 72 are gone. Scoop Jackson died September 1st. Outside of Ted Stevens, you look at that Senate and there's nobody there. They don't know who you are, for the most part. They don't know the history of this. They don't know the social and legal injustice that led to the adoption of ANCSA. You're starting from scratch. You're dealing with people that, by and large, have other priorities. You're talking about resources and people problems. It's acid rain. That's what the people that you have to deal with are concerned about. So the opportunities aren't great, so I wouldn't try to be too ambitious in terms of what you go after in terms of reorganizing the institutional arrangements. I would try to make the ones you've got work and work better. I'd try to open up some new opportunities, and I'd do it only to the extent that you win, which means one of the things you ought to strive for up here is consensus and political consensus among the Native group, because you can't win at all. You can't even get a hearing unless you've got some consensus when you go down there. So you've got big problems to thrash out up here. And on that point, I think that you've got to be specific. And I think one of my concerns about being here today, one of the concerns about the papers I read, the red coming in, and specifically the overview, short overview paper on these hearings, is that it lacks specificness. It's dealing in philosophy, it's dealing in ethical questions, it's local, but it's also international in scope, it's dealing with culture, it's dealing with social welfare relationships between business corporations and the land, and these are important things to think about, to discuss. It's important that you have philosophical bearings and are able to make the relationships and think about them and understand them between land management and cultural aspirations and social welfare concerns and the operation of business corporations. But that's a lot to swallow, and nobody's ever going to agree on that. These are the kinds of questions that people at the margin are always still in disagreement. So I think you've got to look at some specific things, have some specific objectives, find some specific agreement on things. And these are the tax questions, obviously, the problem of the afterborn, the questions of alienability. Look for new opportunities, as opposed to taking apart something that doesn't work quite 100% perfect and spending all your energies trying to get it back together with the knowledge you probably won't get it back together as good as it was. Think about some opportunities you can get when that legislative opportunity opens up. And opportunities are things, from your point of view, that Congress doesn't have a point of view on. Present them a new something. And by and large, you get tremendous goodwill there. The Alaska Native people and their leadership are the most competent group of legislators and lobbyists I've ever seen in my life. They can get in any door. Doors that people that are in the lobbyist business as a profession, to some extent, I do a little bit of that. It's tough to get indoors. But you take an Alaska Native person, and especially one in traditional garb down there, and you can get them in any door, sell damn near any story, as long as somebody isn't around to contradict it. So you've got great opportunities. I would keep it practical, pragmatic, and go after some of those opportunities. And on that score, Mr. Chairman, either under the aegis of this commission, under the federal 85 study that's being done, or under something that the Native corporations themselves ought to commission and see that gets done, is that we need a baseline, and we need it right now within the next year to measure the question that we're talking about here. Has there been any progress? I haven't seen anything to compare with the Alaska Natives and the Land, any one book that brings together the data that would let me judge whether this ANCSA experience was worth a damn. What progress has there been? Is housing better in the villages and for your people now than it was in 72? Is their level of educational attainment better? Is the delivery of medical services better? Is the incidence of alcoholism down? Are families steadfast in maintaining a nuclear family unit? Is that up since 72? And I suspect the answer to these questions are that they're mixed. Probably alcoholism and suicide and some of these things may be about the same as they were then. Maybe they're higher. But don't let that back you off in terms of going and getting the data and publishing it and comparing it. Because that's what happens when people are given cash, when there's a lot of inflow of population, when there's a lot of opportunity. Look at Wyoming, coal development there 15 years ago. Used to be a state where divorce was unheard of, alcohol wasn't a problem. Hell, after coal and the money started pouring in there and the new people, off the scale in terms of the nation, led the nation and all those things. On the other hand, these questions about housing, average family income levels, less quantitative things such as opportunity to get university education if they want it for a village kid. These are important statistics. These are statistics that people can understand, and you can make some judgment. Have you made progress since 82? They're also very important in terms of selling your case. Now, when you go back to Congress, Congress is going to say, and a lot of these guys are going to say, 40 million acres and $1 billion. I want to see what the progress is before you come in and ask me to, A, change the institutions or help you out in some other way in terms of more land or even doing land exchanges, consolidations. And I highly recommend land exchanges because they don't cost anything net. It's a trade with the federal government. It's improving land use management. It's also a great opportunity for your villages, for your corporations to get something that may be exceedingly more valuable than that icy mountain that's in their backyard. It may be an opportunity to go after land as an economic unit, that land that has hard rock mineral potential, has oil and gas potential, or timber, tourism potential, residential thing. I agree with Doug. This is your land, and your land is your life, but it's also your asset. You made trade-offs. You got 40 million acres, and there are units of that that can be used. It doesn't mean necessarily giving it up, that a lot of the land in Native ownership in Alaska is unburdened. It's in your ownership, but it's subject to long-term leases. And those leases are very, very valuable. Millions and millions of dollars are paid for them. And hopefully, there will be millions and millions of dollars of royalty and income coming out of those that you'll all benefit from because of 7i and so forth. So there are two sides to these transactions. They do both need to be looked at carefully. Don't get stampeded into only looking at one side of the transaction because there's political rhetoric or arguments that can be made about the sacredness of the land or so forth. Weigh them, evaluate them, look at the other side of the question and make rational decisions that are rational economically but are also rational from a cultural, social, historical point of view in terms of where you're going or where your people are going or where that particular village wants to go and what trade-offs they want to make. And it's got to get down to localized levels in terms of a lot of those decisions, and I think the leadership in most of the regional corporations recognize that, and it makes it more difficult. One other point I wanted to make, there was a lot of discussion earlier about the difficulty of the regional corporation or the village corporation doing things because it's a politicized process. That it's kind of like running a municipality, that there's real electioneering to get on the board of directors, people are running slates, they're out campaigning. It is true that relatively little of that happens with the modern day business corporation per se, but it does happen. There are fights to get proxy fights to get people on the board of directors. There are hostile takeover attempts and tender offers. Look at Boone Pickens and Mesa Petroleum going after Gulf right now. That's a political process. They've got public relations people. They got lobbyists. So that's not alien to the corporate world. You get it differently, though, because your corporations, and by your choice, you've made them not only business-for-profit corporations, that, as Byron was saying, get measured by a very, very tough standard, and that is generating profit, being lean, mean, and hard, having no excess baggage. Well, by and large, you aren't doing it that way. You want to make profit. Most of them do make profit. But you also made conscious decisions that you're going to be a social welfare organization that's going to fill in behind the feds, behind the state, and behind local government. And you're going to employ so many of your region's people as a decision that has nothing to do with economics. It's to train people, to train them to leadership positions. It's to pump money into local economies. And you're making conscious decisions like that. Now, that makes it harder to run a corporation and be profitable and have the kind of bottom line that you'd all like, or at least that your managers would like. But you're performing a governmental kind of function here that is not being backed into, I don't think. It's an outright political choice that you're making. In many cases, I think it's the right choice. It's tough to do when the economy is hard and interest rates are 20%, as they have been recently. It's terribly tough to do, but part of your culture, your spirit, you're caring about one another, or at least that's the way I read it. And I don't think it's wrong, per se. I wouldn't run away from it, because it's accomplishing other objectives that just don't flow to the bottom line in Arthur Anderson's report. But you can see the results when you look around some of the communities, some of the corporations, and what they mean. Finally, I'd go into this commission proceedings and everything else you do over the next couple of years with a heavy, heavy sense of political realism about what it's going to be possible to get done in your legislature and the federal Congress. And I wouldn't create any expectations that are too large, because if you do, those of you with village and regional corporations, you're going to have real, real problems. I wouldn't, obviously you're all way too smart to overpromise, but this whole question of creating the expectation, especially among the less sophisticated people in the village, less sophisticated in the sense that they don't understand the institutions on a day-to-day basis, you're going to create a problem that I don't know how you're going to cure, because I just don't see too terrible much being delivered over the next 4 to 5 years in terms of fundamental change and new institutions and tapping of new money and giving back some of these parks and refuges that were established a couple of years ago to either the state or to the native people. As I said earlier, I think consensus is very, very important. I think timing is also very, very important. So I try to get together on a consensus business as soon as possible, because even when once you get it together, you may not have the right timing, and you may have to sit on it for a while. And I think proceedings of this commission, the involvement of the people in the villages, distinguished panel you have here, and the many others that will be heard from, I think can be very, very, very important. But I would keep it politically realistic, focus on the practical, or where you're not focusing on the practical, make clear that everybody in the audience understands that you're now operating at a different level. We're going to talk philosophy, we're going to talk ethics, we're going to talk about the ideal world, and make sure that some distinctions are being made here. Again, this problem of creating expectations that cannot or probably cannot be fulfilled is a very, 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 very important one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Van Ness. Point you made about the database, that is, statistics comparing the position of Alaska Natives from the point of view of health, housing, education, welfare, and so on. I believe that that is a job being undertaken by the Secretary's 1985 study, the Secretary of the Interior's 1985 study. I think that's what that study is about, and I think those statistics will be made available.
Point out, though, that part of the interesting history about the Native Claims Settlement Act is that in 1968, when the Congress, at least the Senate, had the first hearings on the question, we had the Department of Interior up to ask them, well, who are these Native people? Where do they live? How many of them are there? What are their social welfare conditions? What's their education? And I must say it was the most miserable, embarrassing experience of my life that they couldn't answer, even begin to answer any of those questions. Further, they said they didn't have the capacity to go out and find any of the answers, which led Senator Jackson to say, well, he was going to go out and take Senate money and hire Rand Institute or Battelle Memorial Lab to go out and search the data files and find that information. And Senator Bartlett said, no, I won't agree to that. We've got a little thing in Alaska called the Federal Field Committee that came out of the Alaska earthquake, and I'll have Joe Fitzgerald come and see you. And he did, and they did the study for, I think, $400,000. And was it 55? Well, we're piggybacking some other money at any event.
No, that's all the field committee spent, anyway.
At any event on it. They may be the appropriate people to do it now, but I'd have more confidence, I think, if it were done by some institution like that or a state institution or by the Native community itself.
Judge, if I can say one thing, not really a comment, but I think that last point in answer to your question is an important one. I don't have all the details of what the Interior Department is doing for that study, but totally aside from the record in the past, I would be amazed, based on what I know now about the way they're proceeding, that they will produce a report with the requisite sensitivity and continuity from the earlier report that it would give anybody what they need. I think they're doing it, and I think what they do will be useful, but absent some fairly independent recitation and then disciplined study, I don't think you'll get answers to this whole chain of questions Bill asked about whether things have really gotten better over the past few years.
Maybe we should ask Joe Fitzgerald to come out of retirement in Montana and gather the team one more time.
Mr. Hickok.
Let me comment. As one who operates a information and database in Alaska and probably has as much of this information handy as anybody, I can assure you that the 1985 study has not made any contacts with those who have the information. And I find that incredibly crazy.
I'm sorry I brought it up. Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, I would like to just make one brief comment, Mr. Van Ness, about what you referred to about the use of the corporations and the fact that we have consciously, in some case, taken on some what might be called unbusinesslike or social type of activities. The problem that we have when we're faced or we're saddled with a corporation or this type of thing is that we're graded by two differing standards and sometimes contradictory standards. At one point, we're graded by a social welfare type of how well we do that type of thing. On the other hand, we're graded on how well we make a profit. And those are contradictory and difficult things for us to be graded upon and have both of those successes be simultaneous, that we have to meet them both, and it's impossible to do.
Agree with you 100%. You're walking a tightrope in terms of doing that by comparison to every other corporate manager that only has to look to the bottom line and be graded there, because your annual meeting is going to grade you on the social welfare contribution as well as hold you to an austere standard of profitability, and that's tough and impossible. But I think it's a high compliment to many of you that you have performed so well in carrying that out. But maybe that is a thing that your people need to address, and I don't know what the answer to it is. Maybe it's running community colleges, vocational training or something. I don't know, but as a stopgap basis, I think you've done a very admirable job.
Can I quote your compliment in my annual report?
Forgive me, the only reason I interrupt these exchanges by mentioning your name is just so it's on the record. I think that we should allow Walter Parker to get back into this this thing now, and then some of the people sitting at Mr. Parker's table might want to make an observation or ask a question, I welcome Mr. Joe Upikson, who was with us earlier in the week, and I'm glad to say has joined us again. So, Mr. Parker, would you go ahead?
Yes, thank you. I was very happy Byron Mallott opened a discussion and speaking of developing a moral imperative. I skirted around this somewhat in the paper, and it was what I was addressing somewhat in creating a sensitivity through the educational process and other means in developing an overall reasonable consensus on what the future of Alaska is going to consist of. Certainly there has never been a claim settlement without that moral imperative had not been developed once, and it certainly can be done again, maintaining and sustaining such a thing for the long period. I view as the, you know, one of the major roles of major institutions in the state of Alaska. The university, elements of the state government need to have been charged with doing this sort of thing and need to continue to do it. But as in following your lead, Mr. Chairman, and going back a bit, why certainly Western capitalism shaped the Protestant Reformation to suit its needs and provide it with the moral imperative that it needed for development. And no ongoing major social development of any scale, and viewing our own social development here as a major scale to us at least, can proceed without